Hi, my name is Divya Ravi Kumar Grant, and I'm here interviewing for, as part of the Equality, Diversity and Inclusion Committee in the University of Galway. And today we're interviewing Dr. Sean Pert. Sean, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, very nice to be on this. Thank you. My name is Sean. My pronouns are he, him.
Brilliant. And so I suppose we'll just get stuck in. Why did you choose speech and language therapy?
Well, it's a funny story, really, because I would really, I'm probably the least likely person to become a speech therapist of anybody, because I'm from a mining town, a coal mining town in North Nottinghamshire, and I was born in a pit house. I was born actually delivered by an Irish midwife, which is
Oh,
why my name is spelled SEAM, because she said to my mother, "I hope you're going to spell it the correct way."
lovely.
So that's that connection. But my father, my older brother, my uncle, my cousins, my other uncle, my other cousin, all coal miners.
Okay.
So it was very much expected that I would follow in that path, and I really did want to. So my mother was in a kind of amateur children's theatre group, and she acted alongside two speech therapists. Now, one of them was a man and one of them was a woman. So I thought this was the normal kind of flow of things, that that it was kind of equal gendered, and as we'll probably talk about later, that didn't turn out to be the case. But yes, I was very much kind of intrigued about what this profession was, because it was really appealed to me, because I was really kind of drawn to the medical side, but I thought, I don't really want to work in medicine. And I was really kind of drawn also to teaching, so this seemed a good amalgam of the two areas, really. So that's why it was attractive to me.
That makes sense. And so I suppose, was it one of those things where you were kind of really stepping out of your comfort zone, deciding to pick something that was just so different to everybody else in your family? Or was it something that you kind of suspected you might do anyway?
It was very much a very difficult thing to do, because no one had been to university from our family. So my mother was really concerned, I later found out, that I would be disappointed and I wouldn't get in. Luckily, I had some, yeah, exactly, I thought, oh, that's great. But it's not because she didn't think I was intelligent enough, but just because no one had ever done it, and it
Yeah,
was just unheard of.
exactly.
And she
And it's a
had.
mum's job to worry as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, and this is one of the things that people don't realize, is that also your social class, if you don't know anyone who's been to university and you've no one to talk to, how do you find out about that, particularly before the internet? I mean, we're talking way before the internet. It was really hard to find out, and I went to the career service, and the career service said, "Can you give us information about this area?" Because it was really, really not understood.
Absolutely.
So I think what really drove me is that I'm, as people will tell you, I'm a very driven, stubborn person. The best way to tell me that to get me to do something is to say I can't do it, because I'll think, right, I'll show you. So I've always been kind of, I always had this vision that I could be like these speech therapists. So I went to a hospital drop-in session for people who'd had a stroke, and I re really found that I could talk to people that I'd never met before, and that I really enjoyed it, and that you could help people just by talking to them seemed kind of magical. So I thought,
No, that makes sense. It
I
really does.
thought, if that's something that I can use my communication abilities for, to help other people, then I thought that would be really fulfilling. And I'm glad to say it has been. So yeah, I think I made the right choice. It's really it really is a career where every day is very, very different.
And every day is kind of fulfilling, and it must be like, it must be interesting, I suppose, that you went in through, meeting speech and language therapists in a theater group as well. Like, I mean,
Yeah.
did you know, like, can you tell me a little bit about the experience of realizing that the course was so female dominated or predominantly women? Like, was that, did
Yeah.
that happen as you were entering the course, or was that
I mean,
before?
I really had no idea. And it was only when I went to kind of open days and then started the course, I was kind of, oh, right. I seem to be, you know, I think I was the only man in my year group. And yeah, very few men throughout. And I don't think any male staff. So yeah, it was just a bit of a surprise, really. And I think it sort of bothered me because there are certain expectations about the way that you interact with people, and that can be quite gendered. So I remember going on placement, my very first placement, and being told I wasn't kind of conforming to what the practice educator thought I should. And it was this very much kind of, you need to be like a children's TV presenter to kind of have a particular style. And I was quite taken aback that this was kind of expected, really, whereas I was quite straightforward.
That's a really unusual piece of advice to get as well. And I have noticed, because we've interviewed a couple of men already for the podcast, and there does seem to be some kind of wacky advice thrown out at some of the guys. Just in terms, I think someone else mentioned that, like, in terms of kind of just the idea of like men in childcare being like, as in it being kind of almost like a men working in, a field that has children in it, being in pediatric speech and language therapy, is almost like this as in there was this advice given to one of the guys in one of the last podcasts that basically was just be expecting people not to trust you, essentially.
I mean, I think that's a common kind of unspoken feeling, really.
It's very
I mean,
dark.
it is. I mean, I point out that, this is a career where you're here to help people. And but there is this expectation even from the service users. So I remember opening the door to my clinic on my first job, and mum was saying, oh, this nice lady's going to talk to you. And then she's like, oh, it's a man. And the child goes burst into tears because it was contrary to what they were expecting, which is understandable. But I've also had good experiences in the particularly boys with DLD really kind of identify, with you and respond better. And I think, I don't want to overplay it because I think everyone's capable of working with all sorts of client groups, but I think there's this kind of expectation that you'll be somehow different,
Of course.
which is odd. And being a lecturer and being a practitioner leading the coordination of placements, as I did for a few years, it was always comments about male therapist interaction styles that came up. And I do think that's highly stereotyped, which is a shame because I think men have a lot to offer in terms of, I mean, just if you think about the client groups with children, I mean, getting dads involved is really important and really
Yes, it
quite
is.
tricky, and it's much easier to talk to another guy about that. So, and I think in terms of role modeling, the lack of diversity, I mean, of all the characteristics, the most askew is gender. I mean, I think we've reached 4% of men, from about 49% of the population. So it really is a massive gap, and it must be something to do with the fact that, if you can't see yourself, you can't be it. And I think that's true of a lot of protected characteristics, but it's true of men. And I think, it's very hard because you've got to invent the role yourself of what your professional persona is going to be like, because there aren't any role models particularly. Well, there weren't at that time, especially.
No, definitely. And even for so was it young boys? What was it, DOD, that you said that they had? I just wanted to ask you. what that
Yeah,
meant.
kids with DL, with developmental language disorder,
Ah, DLD, yeah.
and how they, might interact by, kicking a football or very physical play, and how that can be different. So, I mean, I was saying to a student, we had a very, very active little boy with suspected DLD, and I, we need to do a sorting game. So I put the post boxes on either end of the playground, so he
Yeah.
could run about.
Yeah.
And I know activity's not restricted to just boys, but it is kind of thinking like that, thinking, do you have to do stuff sat at a desk, and you don't, and a lot of play can be very physical and active as well. So yeah, it's interesting that I think there's expectations about how what therapy looks like and what it will be like, and it is largely from, and inevitably so, from that female perspective, because most of the profession are cis female.
Yeah, and that definitely does make a difference, even when it comes to kind of developing, like you said, little games to kind of help kids be involved. Even if, like it's a start to finish thing. If it's primarily cis female, then that's going to filter into so many different aspects of speech and language therapy. Even in terms of kind of like when you consider the older male cohort as well, or do you know what I mean? As in you've got like a group of people who might be more comfortable with another man, or and might not necessarily be able to get that. So it's
It's,
kind
I
of
mean,
complicated.
it is. And I think, I mean, I've worked with clients of all age groups, really, and lots of different gender identities. And it's really interesting in the transgender work I do, because, define a gender, I mean, you just end up resorting to stereotypes. And, I can only speak to my experience. I can't represent every male therapist
Yes.
at all. But I think the intersectionality, I mean, I'm also an out gay man. That was, being a man and being gay and being
Yeah.
out
Yeah.
back in the mid 90s was very challenging. And, I did have parents sort of saying, I'm not sure I want to see you. And I was saying, well, I've got these clinical skills, and it's absolutely something you should talk about. And I mean, as a result, I mean, I often worked with assistants and in rooms where there were, doors open, and making sure, just to protect myself, really, to make sure that everybody knew that everything was, clearly the child was safe. So I think there's an expectation as a result, because of that kind of unspoken issue, that many men might choose, because it's easier to work with adults. And I think that's a shame, because I think men have got an awful lot to offer in terms of child interaction and in role modelling, particularly to boys and to dads. And I think it's a brilliant area to work in. So I'm hoping that we're breaking down those barriers by discussing it openly.
Definitely. And like, you hit on something that's a really difficult aspect of it, which is, the idea of you kind of keeping doors open and having to kind of be aware of this extra layer of your work, is it's a really difficult thing to have to do. And men of color also have to do the same thing in relation to these, you know what I mean, these areas too. And it's just this kind of caginess where people might be apprehensive, they might be discriminatory, but they might just be nervous. They might not know people from a community like yours or mine. You know what I mean? It's there's loads of things going on in a parent's head in those moments, and at the end of the day, you can still empathize with, even if you don't agree with their views, you can empathize with the idea that they want to protect their child. So it's a very tricky situation to navigate, but it also puts a lot of the responsibility back on a minority group like yourself or myself to have to manage, the expectations of somebody else, when in reality you should be able to go in and do your work and, you know what I mean, be treated like everybody else.
I mean, I think what I would say, I mean, I want to say to my students is, even if you're a cis female, you should really have the carers in, because they should be able to see what you're doing, and you're
Yes.
modelling the therapy anyway. So it's a big lost opportunity if parents and carers can't see what's going on. And I think it's being comfortable with being observed. I mean, I'm a big fan of therapy groups, and we really kind of transformed our service when I was a manager in doing therapy groups. I mean, they're great fun. And you know, if you're trying to be a teacher, you're always you're always in a group. Therapists are very, you know, often quite shy to show their clinical skills, but actually we should be open to feedback. We should be open to parents going, but why did you do that? And how did you get
Yes.
my child to do that? So I think on the positive side, it's probably made me more reflective and, you know, challenging. You know, I mean, I had a parent many years ago, thankfully, but kind of challenging me because saying, you know, you're an openly gay man, why should I leave my child with you? And I was saying, well, you don't leave your child with me. You're going to be in there and we're going to show you how to work with your child. And she became a huge, you know, proponent for me and was saying, you know, he was a great therapist to work with. But I think it is about kind of challenging. I mean, most parents think that they leave their child with you and to get fixed, when we know that most of the facilitation of language, the sound practice and stuff is done between therapy sessions. You know, we're supposed to be showing how to do that and empower parents and carers. So I think you've always got to find the positive side of things, and that's the side I find really.
Yeah, and that's a lovely way to look at it too. And oftentimes it can be, you know, it can be a case of people needing some time with you to be able to understand, do you know what I mean? That you're the same as anybody else in that situation. So yeah, you know, as in it's always nice when somebody turns around and actually realizes that it is actually very satisfying.
And I think as well, you know, you need to, you know, not apologize for being who you are. And I think the realizing that sometimes it's a massive advantage. So if you're working with, you know, dads, male carers, male partners, and they're saying, well, I don't communicate like that, you know, you can say, yeah, that's fine, that's just who you are. And it's really good to kind of have those connections with people. And I think, you know, in terms of my trans work, I can demonstrate, you know, a cis male voice, and I can also demonstrate intermediate and non-binary and female voice, because I've practiced that. So it's kind of showing people that, you know, these things are possible. So there are advantages to your identity as well as disadvantages.
Definitely, and it's a really beautiful thing. I think the work that speech and language therapists can do with trans people is just it's so interesting. It's something I only learned about through the podcast because I suppose it hadn't been an area like my background is in dietetics, so I'm allied health, but I'm far away from you guys in a lot of ways. So I have been learning loads about speech and language therapy through, you know, talking to people and learning about these experiences. And I just think the work that you guys can do with trans people is just so transformational.
Yeah, I think the voice is so close to your identity. I mean, we say
Yes.
about people having a voice, people, you know, speaking their truth. It's all related to the voice. And if you have a voice that doesn't match how you feel, then that dysphoria can be really affecting. So to be able to use, frankly, a lot of voice techniques are from theatre, from performance, and but then making it into somebody's automatic, authentic voice that's aligning it with their true identity is really, really fulfilling. But it's also great fun, and I think that's one of the things that we forget to kind of tell people just coming into this career, that the reason I do voice work is because I absolutely love it. It's just, and we make mistakes and we laugh together. And, you know, I think showing service users that some of this stuff is hard, you know, it's quite
Yes.
tricky
Yeah.
and it takes a lot of practice. And, you know, when I started this work, I sat in front of a video camera and a microphone, changing my voice according to the resonance, to the pitch, to both factors, breathiness, trying and experimenting and doing voice exploration work, so that when someone says to me, how do you do this? I've got some experience of that, because I think it's very easy to come across as the expert when really the most effective clinical kind of effect is from a partnership, is from
Yes.
kind of co-producing with people. So, and not making assumptions, you know, and I always say to people, you know, what sort of voice are you aiming for? What kind of qualities? How's that reflecting you as a person? And not assuming gender roles, and those kind of things. And I think, you know, the world is much more interesting because of diversity. If you think of diverse people, you know, whether they're actors, scientists, or whatever, diversity gives you a bit of a left field view of things, and often that is enough to give you that creative spark and develop things. You know, and a lot of LGBT people of color have that different perspective, so they're able to kind of see things perhaps from a better perspective at times. So there's a lot to be said for your diversity giving you a, I like to think of diversity as a sort of superpower.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it especially I suppose it's been interesting hearing people talking about people who are bilingual or people with immigrant parents and that level of shame that they like a parent might come in with if it comes to them feeling like they're contributing to their kids mispronouncing words or you know what I mean as in that idea of like we're supposed to be training them now in this accent that you know what I mean is of the place that we've moved to now. It's this, I feel like there's this movement in speech and language therapy that I'm really kind of hearing about and like where it seems like speech and language therapists are really encouraging parents to keep, the languages that they have alive at home and, making sure that they don't feel shame about, where they've come from or how they sound. And it's not about, I suppose, trying to make you sound a specific way.
No, I mean, I think that's been one of the themes that's run throughout my career. I mean, as I said earlier, you know, I came from a mining town which was incredibly monolithic, white, mining kind of working class people. So moving to Birmingham and then Manchester to these multicultural centres and being exposed to culture, food, music, languages that I had never really encountered was just really exciting for me. And that's why I've always kind of found it, you know, just so beautiful that these languages exist. I mean, I speak with a northern, a broadly Midlands to northern accent. And we know that even from employment perspectives, that people judge you on your accent, you know, your class, your intelligence, et cetera, you know. And I think, you know, I teach phonetics at Manchester University, and we teach the local accent and dialect, because that's what the students are going to encounter out there on placement. You know, it's not about correcting anything, you know, because as we said earlier, your speech or language is really close to who you are. It's really part of your identity. And you know, I was involved in one of the first setting one of the first services with Dr. Carol Stowe, who's now retired, but she was instrumental in setting up one of the first, we had a bilingual care pathway and a monolingual care pathway, and all our assessment and treatment was in home language.
Oh, fantastic.
We devised lots of assessments and therapy packages, which we're still carrying on today. I've just this last month we've produced an expressive language assessment in Malay Alam, and our therapy package, Building Early Sentences Therapy, when we did a randomized control trial on that with Newcastle University and Professor Christina McKean, we had resources that were in languages other than English. So big languages like Polish, under-recognized languages like Mirpuri, which is a Pakistani heritage language, and Sylheti, which is a form of Bangla. And I think those other languages are really, really important, because if we assess and treat in English only, we're giving the message that only that matters, that only English matters. And we know it's a myth that learning, you know, giving up your home language will enhance your education or your ability to speak English. We know that's nonsense. Bilingual children are better additional language learners because they've got this basis to work on. So never in my career have I said to anyone, you have to work in English. It's always been, let's promote your home language, let's do work in your home language. And that's why now I'm very pleased to say I've got one of the first websites for speech therapists in the UK, speechtherapy.co.uk, has all those links to languages other than English resources, so assessments, therapy, and work that other people have done. And my lockdown project, because I live in West Yorkshire, so I have a long commute, about an hour and a half each way. So during lockdown, I said, I'm going to write this in a book. So it's a, as you would expect from a speech therapist, it's got a snappy title, Working with Children and Families Experiencing Speech and Language Disorders in a Bilingual Context, because it's not about typical bilingualism, colon, a home language approach. But it's that a home language approach that's really important, because both from a linguistic point of view, that, if you're a parent, your home language is your best language, it's perfect, all the nuances, and it's a fantastic foundation for learning language. But also, it's how can you understand your religion, your culture, your the way you feel about your community without having those conversations with your gran, your uncle, auntie in home language. You lose so much, because language is the transmission of culture. You just lose all that transmission. So I think it's really, really such a fantastic golden opportunity to learn your home language, to acquire your home language, because you don't learn it, you just pick it up in the early years. And such a shame if you don't have an opportunity to do that. And I don't see why speech and language disorders should get in the way of that.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I think a lot of people obviously approach speech and language therapy thinking it's about diction and thinking it's kind of like speech and drama, which is
Yes.
such a misconception. But I do feel like it's, even for myself, coming from two immigrant parents
Yeah.
and, like as in my parents were doctors. And so they're, they were, speaking, they'd learned in English, they spoke English, but they're, they still had accents. And from that perspective, it
Yeah.
was one of those kind of situations where, like, even in our home, myself and my sister have Irish accents and my parents don't. And,
Yeah.
it took me a long time, I think, as a kid, and I think it can take a while as a kid to kind of feel like you're, sometimes you wish that, you were almost fully one or the other. And I think that the world can kind of make you feel like it'd be great if you either had the same accent as your parents, or you know what I
Oh
mean? It's one of those
absolutely.
things where it can feel very like you're in and out. But for those kids, I think a lot of the time, I think the parents, are doing their best to make it feel like, we should push where you're from, where you're from, where you're living now, where your home is, and make sure that there's a push towards English in that way. But while doing that, it's really important to recognize, that heritage really matters, being able to communicate with your family really matters. And
It
those
does.
things were ma they mattered for me growing up. And also when it comes to that idea of people, making you feel like you should kind of conform in a way, that's going to happen regardless of what the parents
Oh,
do.
yeah,
That's happening
absolutely.
anyway. So the parents might as well be, encouraging their home language, encouraging, their culture, all of that at home, because they're going to get, like, these people are going to get enough cues from the
I
outside
think so.
world to change.
I agree with you. And I think the solid science tells us that this, it's kind of, it is a complete myth that giving up your home language will increase your English abilities. It will just mean you miss out. And I think we really need to get that message over. I remember talking to a dad at a local nursery saying, "Why do you want my kid to speak our language?" And I said, "Well, what did you do today?" He told me. And he went, "Well, I went to the market," and I said, "I bet you talked to the stall holders, because you'll know them and they'll give you a nice deal." And he's going, "Oh yeah, you have to kind of, barter your way and stuff and get see what the deals are on." And I said, "Which language did you do that?" And he said, Mehpri, which is his Pakistani heritage language. He said, "Then," I said, "What did you do then?" He said, "Well, I went to the community centre and talked to my dad, and he likes to use his Urdu, and use his Urdu with the other guys, show how how he can do that." And I said, "And you could chat with him as well." He said, "Oh yeah, absolutely." So then you came to the nursery and you spoke to me and the teacher and used English. Do you want your son to be able to do all that and just effortlessly move between the languages and cultures?" "Well, yeah." And I said, "Well, he's not going to do that if he's not going to learn your home languages. So, if he only knows English, he's not going to be able to speak to your land. He's not going to be able to speak to the market traders. He's not going to have those advantages of understanding your world like you effortlessly can. And it had honestly never occurred to him that that would be the upshot of abandoning his home language. And I think too often we ignore that internalized racism, that we're, that othering of people. And, it's about, isn't it, normalizing. If you live in a city particular, you can, people are much more anonymous and you can hear lots of different languages. But if you're in a town, people can give you horrible looks and things like that. It's the same with any behavior that people find that they don't share. They're suspicious of it. And education is the cure to that. But in the meantime, as speech therapists, we should really, because we know all this evidence, we know these outcomes, we should be supporting parents to understand that their home language is a gift.
Definitely. And I think so many other aspects of the world and so many other careers will inadvertently push towards assimilation. I think that it's really beautiful to hear about a career where you can kind of help people to keep some of their heritage and keep some of their culture, because it is what you're saying is kind of it's bang on, the idea of being able to like weave between the two communities, because you're inevitably going to have to do that if if you have two cultures. So from that
Absolutely.
perspective, it's lovely. It's just really nice and very heartening for me to hear that, because I grew up,
Well,
in
good. Well, good.
very much so. Like I grew up in a place where, like, for me, I was the Ireland that I was born into, in 96 was very different, because there was very few people of color at the time. I mean, there's been a huge influx of people of color, different cultures, this kind of vibrancy that's come into Ireland in the last 15 odd years. But when I was, a kid, I was like an alien on the playground, like as in everybody was staring at me. And I just, my automatic inclination was to kind of push towards being as Irish as possible. My Irish, when I left, school, my Irish was one of the, like, I had the best Irish in the class. Like, I was really, really good. I was up there. Do you know what I mean? I was not quite at the top as, the people who had all these people they could refer to, because I had no family to speak in Irish with. But I was like just up there and kind of in that top group because I wanted to be there and I wanted to make this a thing, and it took me a long time when I was older. I've reflected back on that and I was like, a part of that was because I really love language, but a part of that was, a huge part of that was because I felt like I had something to prove. And that is exhausting to have to carry around for any group of people.
It is. And let's think about the loaded kind of value we attach to certain languages. If you
Exactly.
speak French, people are like, oh, how marvelous.
Yes.
Wonderful that you can go to Paris and go shopping. And actually, that what is the difference between that and speaking a language that a person of color might speak? And the difference is the value we attach to a particular language.
Definitely.
And, English has a high status. European languages have high statuses because they're associated with, successful communities. But, culture really, if you know your history, if you look at when writing was invented, if you look at, early civilizations, it's not really English based.
No, and
I
like,
think.
yeah, it's about like really understanding that. Like, I mean, for me, so my family are from Chennai, so like they speak Tamil, and Tamil, it took me a long time to realize. I looked into the history of Tamil and I was like, oh my God, this language is like is ridiculously old. It's actually one of the oldest languages in the world. This is amazing. And I just remember when I learned about that, and I'd kind of been almost devaluing this in my head, but also a part of that is because if you're walking past, on any given day, if you're walking past a group of French people speaking French, there is a completely different mentality to it versus walking past a group of people speaking Tamil. And there is an aspect of it where, people speaking Tamil in that situation might be more conscious that other people think that they're talking about them. And that's a huge aspect of it. And whereas the French people could easily be doing exactly the same thing, but it's just not perceived in the same way.
Absolutely. No. And that is that covert racism that is attached to languages. And I just find it really infuriating that people can't see that all languages and cultures are beautiful and valuable, and this pull between integration and maintaining your identity. I often say to parents, they'll thank you, the kids will thank you, but not till they're in their 20s and decide to go, oh yeah, this is really great. And I think as well, the lack of education about other cultures, the lack of education about the history of of racism and empire and colonialism, where a lot of these attitudes come from, it means that people don't know why they have these beliefs. And as you say, if you start to research the history of your language and your culture, that's so important to show speakers and members of the community how important and valuable and historic their culture is. And I think, Britain, Ireland, and lots of Europe are multicultural and multi-faith and multilingual, and that adds, I mean, I really laughed when a few years ago they were saying, the most popular British dish is chicken tikka masala. You just think that's great because it so speaks of our multicultural society, and that, everyone's obsessed with food, but it's do we value those cultures that brought this fantastic cuisine to our community? And
Are we
do people
seeing
even
people
know
behind the
why
food?
they're here?
Yes, definitely.
And how many people know about partition? How many people know about the politics around that? So I'm pleased to see that things like podcasts and things like that are helping people to be more educated. But yeah, it is, we need to call it what it is, and it is linguistic racism, and we have to really say it's really important to value your culture and your home language.
Definitely. And I think that this is the first conversation in which we've really touched on that because, it is really important to recognize that we all carry this bias, myself included. Like, as in, I've had so much unlearning to do. It took me a long time to realize, even as a kid, like, it's so shameful to say it now, but like, you do think that because you have you're more assimilated, almost like you get an extra gold star somehow
Oh,
for. You know what I mean? You can't not grow up feeling that way because the world is enforcing that. People are very like, go you essentially, or like, people still, even now, like, people tell me and my mother and my father, and my sister that like you've got very good English. It still happens. You know what I mean?
It's really, it's not a compliment, is it? It's like, how, I mean, it was really interesting because we had, four or five bilingual speech and language therapy assistants. We would have families coming in and saying, oh, I didn't realize you were Asian because you had a local
Yeah,
accent.
that
Like,
happens to me all the time.
you've lived in this, you've lived in our community all this time. Really? Really? I mean, it really isn't a compliment. It really is a form of racism that speaks to the lack of education and contact between communities. And I think, I mean, when I'm adapting assessments, I'm not the language expert. I can't speak 300 plus languages that are spoken in Central Manchester. And, if you can, please give me a ring. I'll give you a job. But, it's what I do have is the linguistic skill to help somebody to reflect on their language and help to produce culturally appropriate. So, and they're hand in hand. So, when we're looking at pictures that we're showing children and adults, is this something that somebody will recognize? Does your community use this language structure? That's where we've got to start. There's no point trying to start with a test aimed at English monolingual children or adults and trying to adapt that because the culture is the wrong culture. You talk about different things, even food and there's assessments where the cutlery is used. Well, if you don't use cutlery, which is most of my Pakistani heritage and Bangladeshi heritage families, then right from the start, you've got a cultural disadvantage there. So we have to design assessments from the ground up, from that community. And that's exactly what we do because, I mean, a good example, I was like, in the research project we've just done, we needed to assess comprehension skills. And there's one show me waving, which seems like a really simple verb. And our interpreter said, I've interpreted it like this. I'm going, what on earth is this? Moving hand from left to right. Basically, kids don't wave. They're taught to clap. They don't really wave. And there isn't really a way of saying this in that language. So just got rid of it and put something else in. What is the point in trying to crowbar one culture and one language into another when it doesn't work for the purpose that we have, which is to find out if kids can understand the language that they hear around them? That is what we must lose sight of.
No, I completely agree with you on that, and it's interesting, I suppose. What I'm wondering about now is, like, was that something that you had to, like, is that something that's been a change over the course of your career, or is that something that, like, you felt was at the forefront of your learning when you were in college?
It wasn't taught. It really wasn't taught. And in fact, code switching, where you use two languages in the same sentence or conversation, was widely thought to be, a sign of confusion, that we'd confuse children by speaking two languages, which of course is laughable. Children know who speaks which language, and almost all bilingual children and adults use words that are most appropriate. So if you want to code switch, you'll use an you'll borrow an English word. I
Absolutely.
remember,
I do it all the time. Like I yeah, absolutely.
absolutely. And I remember a student saying, "Isn't that really strange?" And I said, "Oh, don't be so blasé, as if English doesn't nick words left, right, and centre. I had such Schadenfreude about it."
Yeah, it's you're
So
dead right, like,
you
and
know, English does that all the time, doesn't it, in English
yeah,
speakers? And then it's erudite. But if you do it in your bilingual, it's somehow a sign of confusion.
yeah, and even when you're looking at it, I think from it's like words like bungalow come from Hindi, and you're looking at it, you know what I mean? And you're like, this is a mishmash. All of these, like, the English language is made up of so many kind of contradictions and also, like, influences from other cultures. Like, it's one of those things where, when you really kind of look at it properly, it of course it makes sense if you have words in other languages that you should bring them into the fold.
I mean, that's it. Words are tools. I remember one of my older clients saying, "Oh, I need to have a deco at that, because that comes from, Pakistani and Indian heritage languages as well." So it goes both ways. And I think when I started out, it was really, I suppose, because, I mean, I spoke earlier about my superpower. I mean, I think, being a gay man, I was very aware that, the world doesn't always look how other people think it, and isn't how it should be. I mean, bearing in mind that assessments, like the Reynel, used to have, a mother in a pinny and a man with a gun, and the question was, who cooks dinner and who shoots the rabbit? I mean, ridiculously, how is it back there in the 50s? Ridiculous stereotyping. So even for English monolingual children, a lot of the assessments were hopelessly out of date. And even now, with how many children, if you think about the Renfrew pitch test, how many children write letters and post them in letterbox in the days of speaking on, FaceTime to grandparents? There's lots of things that are convenient, but perhaps not the best stimulus pictures for children and adults. So when Dr. Carol Stowe, when she set up the bilingual service, people really didn't want to work with bilingual people. It was seen as complicated, challenging, difficult. We didn't really have, I mean, that's the other downside of not having diversity. We didn't really have bilingual speech and language therapists. Now that's changing, thank goodness. But even if we do have more diversity, you're never going to have, if you speak another language, great, you're going to work with two communities, but you're never going to have 300 plus languages. We all need to work with families who we don't share a language with. And
Yes,
that's
of course.
challenging. That's challenging. It's difficult. But I think, I mean, I've always said that I'm professionally nosy. So I want to know how your family lives, how they eat, how they worship, all those kind of things. Because that helps me understand the language input that your child has had and those kind of things. And it was kind of obvious to us as a team that if these children hadn't had a language disorder, if they hadn't had a speech sound disorder, they would have grown up bilingual. They would have learnt their home, acquired their home language rather, effortlessly at home, and then learnt English when they went to school. And they don't need any help to do that. Kids just pick it up. So it's only these disorders that are getting in the way of that. So children might miss out on the first few years of language acquisition, and then they become monolingual English by default because they've missed that opportunity. So what we're doing is putting right what should have always been the case if these disorders hadn't intervened. So for me, equality and equity is about giving. I mean, there's a difference, isn't there, between equal and equitable. There's that drawing of the kids trying to look at the football game, and they've all got three boxes. And if you give the same amount of support to everybody, some kids need more support than others. And I think that's what equity is really about. And we strove for an equitable service. And that is about giving people what they need in order to succeed in their lives. So if you're growing up in a bilingual community, as we were working in Northeast Manchester, these kids needed to speak to their aunties, uncles, extended family, so the only way to do that is to work in home language. Now, the science has caught up with us, if you like, and we now know that these things to be true. But I think even from an ethical, moral point of view, we're working with lots of parents who couldn't really speak very much English. Is it ethical to treat a child for a language disorder, for example, that then means they only speak English and can't speak to their own mother? I couldn't live with myself.
No, I completely agree with you, and it's a really heartbreaking thought.
And it cuts them off from those, and think of the mental health sequelae on that. It really is. And I'm old enough to kind of remember riots and so forth in the north, and largely a lot of the young people suffered racism from the community that they'd acquired English from, but then didn't have sufficient language skills to speak to the support networks in the wider community. So there's a lot of comfort, support, and mental health connection. Yourself. I mean, I'm the same. If I go, I have an LGBT social group in the town I live in, and we set it up because I wanted to have time. We do theatre group, we do singing groups, we have reading groups, cinema groups. I want to spend time with other queer people because I'm comfortable.
Of course.
If you come from a particular community, you want to spend time with your community, and that doesn't mean say you can't. I just mean say I can't go to work and do the job that everyone else can. It doesn't mean say if you're part of another community, you can't play a full and active role. And in fact, it charges your batteries and makes you more able to contribute to the wider society. So I completely refute this idea that not integrating is segregating. I think it's the opposite. I think it charges your batteries, makes you capable and robust, and able to kind of do the rest with mainstream society, and enriches it as a result.
Definitely, definitely. It's really well put as well. And like, was this, I suppose I want to kind of get back to you and your experience as well as a minority. Like, I mean, did you find, was it difficult being not only a man in your course, but also being a gay man? Like, was it?
I mean, I was told by a very friendly lecturer, go and work in adults because you'll be left alone.
Oh,
And
gosh.
they meant well, but it's a bit like the speak English. It's
Yeah, it
that kind
is.
of mean well, but you're from a different generation. You don't understand that. I was really interested in language. My PhD was around bilingual language acquisition. It's really fascinating. And I've worked with so many families and not really had many problems. It's been other professionals that have made comments or been difficult. So yeah, I was really worried I wouldn't get a job. I suspect I didn't get some jobs because of being so out. But thinking back now as an older man, I'm quite pleased because I think I can't fight. It's a bit like, you you can't fight every racism battle. It's exhausting. I
No.
can't fight every LGBT battle.
No, you
And
can't.
I'm hoping that allies will do a lot of that work with us, alongside with us. So for me, I went to a department where it was okay to be out. And in fact, but there were still real problems. I mean, my best friend died of AIDS just after I got my first job, and
I'm
I
so
was
sorry.
completely, thank you. I was completely devastated. But the fact that I was in a department where people knew I was out and could support me was vital.
Yes.
And I think hopefully nowadays, that's, going to be easier. But I still think there's a lot of value in being open and seeing that people will support you, and recruiting people to your side to say, this is gonna be really drain my batteries. I really need some help with this, because you will get, whether it's a microaggression, because things tend to be more subtle these days, or whether it's open hostility, you will get people making assumptions, judging as we start this conversation. And you need that security that your manager's gonna and your team's gonna rally around you. But yeah, it's been a bumpy course, but the people that have stuck with me. So I mentioned Dr. Carol Stowe. She's still my friend today. She's
Yeah.
retired. We live in the same town. I know her children incredibly well. They're adults now. I've known them for such a long time. You really can develop really strong friendships across these challenges. And I would hope today it's easier. I think it probably is different. There are different barriers. It's probably just as hard. There are different barriers. But I think the visibility is really helpful. RCSLT, the Royal College of Speech Language Therapists, have really made links with groups across the profession. And there's still a long way to go. There's still, for all protected characteristics, and for some that aren't protected, like I mentioned earlier, class. I think, we need to recognize there are differences there, and that's the whole of the podcast. But I feel optimistic in that, people are debating and discussing this stuff, and it can be uncomfortable. And I don't particularly want to do all of that work, but when I'm feeling able to, I've always been out, and I've always been myself, and I'm really pleased that I've managed to do that. Has it taken its toll at times? Yes. But then it's also been a fantastic privilege to use my identity to argue for wider acceptance as well. So I think doing things like Manchester Pride, which is huge,
Yeah.
doing local prides, and people seeing their lecturer, their therapist there being completely out, I hope I've inspired some people to do the same who might be LGBT. And
I
I
can't
think.
imagine it wouldn't, honestly. Like, I mean, for me, even thinking of it as a PhD student now, like, it would be a huge deal. Like, in a great way, it'd be so positive. Even the postdocs, I know, that are part of the LGBT plus community, can have such an impact by virtue of just seeing people who are queer being around. Is it just makes a huge difference. But in the teaching community in particular, I feel like it would be so impactful to see, and so heartening for so many students to see, a lecturer at Pride, genuinely.
Thank you for saying that. And I think as well, I think it's always about helping the next generation. So it's been a real privilege to be a lecturer, but I'm always out to my students. But I also think, I come from a generation where there was hardly any bilingual therapists. There were a few, and I got to know them, and that was fantastic. But really encouraging people to say, what's your superpower? What can you bring to this discussion? Because everybody's got their own life experience. And I think, unfortunately, because of the politics around a lot of equality, diversity, and inclusion, people can feel a bit scared asking questions.
Yeah.
And I think, although you shouldn't be asking somebody, all of these questions, these inappropriate questions we've kind of touched on, and there's lots of lovely resources now to educate yourself, it is it is important to, if you're on a course and you're at a university or in a department, getting to know people for who they are and valuing them for who they are. And, really getting to know diversity from, because the best way to know diversity is to know somebody, who lives it. It's,
Yes,
you know, and they're
definitely.
just one person, but you'll observe things, you'll see some of the challenges. And if you can help them, I'm sure they'll help you. It's not about being, everybody at some point, so when I'm with LGBT people, I'm, I've got things that I can help them with, and vice versa. So I think it's really important to A, be open if you're able to, but also to ask for help if you need as well from people who might not share your protected characteristic, but can make life ri that rich tapestry. Because I want a profession where there are people of color who are, there are people who are bilingual, and there are people who are LGBT, and we can all do a fantastic job and bring something to that rich quilt of knowledge, of life knowledge, so we can make things better for our clients, our service users.
That's lovely. And like, I genuinely think it's a really, it's lovely to hear about somebody working in that kind of space. And I suppose I'm thinking about it from the, like, from your perspective, was it a case that, like, when you went into college, when you went into, jobs, did you feel like you essentially had to come out again every time, or did you have to
Oh,
tell people?
you have to come out all the time. I
I
mean,
just think that must be so exhausting.
it really is. It really is. And I think it's this kind of assumption and the assumptions that people make that are really exhausting. So when I first started doing trans work, I had, let's just say there was another colleague in Manchester who was kind of saying, should you be doing this work? And is this something you should be doing? And, kind of hinting, might you be trans and all these kind of things. And I was really like, this has nothing to do with you. B, I'm not gonna discuss, anything
It's
with
so
you.
inappropriate.
It's so inappropriate. And I think that's what kind of I was touching on earlier is, in what arena are we discussing this in? If you're a friend of mine over coffee and we're talking about me or you,
Yeah.
then probably appropriate because we know each other really well. If you're a colleague, no. And I think as well, things like people will say, well, why do you have to have rainbow flags on your door and stuff? Well, you've got a picture of you and your family and kids on your
Yeah.
this intersectionality as well, people forget that people are more complex than just one identity.
Definitely.
So, it's really, really important that people kind of view people as complex and not just as one particular identity. I mean, I might be a gay man, but I'm also obsessed with 1980s vinyl and cooking sourdough bread. It's
Yeah.
there's far more to me than my sexuality, and it's probably the least interesting thing about me. But the other mistake that people make is, I mean, somebody wrote to me, one of our members wrote to me and said, why do you keep mentioning your sexuality? And I said, well, I would be a gay man if I was celibate.
Yeah.
I never had a partner ever again. I'd still be a gay man
Yes.
because it's about your identity, and it's about the way you perceive the world. It's the way that you interact with people, and that's as important a part to me as another important aspect your makeup is to you. And I think it's really important that people don't make assumptions. I've met families when I've been doing a clinic for speech sound disorders, where dad is trans, and yet you have people saying, do I have to do the trans training because I don't work with adults? Well, no, you don't work with trans adults, but trans people
Yet
have
you're going,
kids and
yes,
bring them to clinic.
absolutely.
So, it's like we don't just exist in one setting, and we cross all of those life barriers. So I think it's then when it's most important that people are not making assumptions and are being as welcome as possible. And you might get it wrong. Can I just say that? I
Yes, of
don't think
course.
I've always got it right. I meet people from loads of different backgrounds and cultures, and I explain all the time, why am I asking this question? Why do I need to know this so that
Yeah.
they understand where I'm coming from? But you will inevitably get things wrong, and I think that's human. But what we shouldn't do is give up and be intimidated because we've got something wrong. We should use that as a learning experience. And I think we have to be tolerant of each other because we don't know what each other's lives are like. We don't know what's going on in people's heads. And mental health is a really good example of that, isn't it? Someone can look really, and in the LGBT community, there's a real kind of overrepresentation of mental health problems.
Yeah.
And when I was younger, people were going, "Oh, that's proof being gay is a sort of mental disorder,
Yeah, or it's bad for you somehow.
yeah." And I was saying, "Well, you try experiencing discrimination every turn
Yeah.
and see if you have a go at
Exactly. It's
it."
like the fact that you're telling me that is part of the problem.
Yes, and I think that's now. I mean, I really recognize there was lots of hysteria over AIDS at the time when I was qualifying. And now I see that in my service users who are trans and non-binary, and you get, people are genuinely terrified to go out on the streets and things because they think they're going to be attacked, and sometimes are attacked. And, when I've been doing groups, I've worn t-shirts that say some people are trans, get over it. And some people have said, people might think you're trans. And I go, and wouldn't that be dreadful?
I know.
Why does that
Yeah,
matter?
why does it
So
matter?
what?
What do you mean by that piece?
So what?
Kind of pick apart why you're saying it in the first place, but also, yeah, you're living like in a world where, like, yeah, I mean, being trans and being like walking outside your front door can be the most exhausting thing in the whole world.
Absolutely, absolutely. And going back to the voice work, sort of when people saying, I was having a lovely time with girlfriend of mine, we were going shopping, and then I was in the changing room thinking, I can't speak because if I speak, I might give my gender identity into doubt, and people might then react in a
That's so
negative way.
horrible.
And you just think, basic safety,
Yeah.
it's really, regardless of what you think of anybody. And I think that's also important to say. I've worked with a lot of families who wouldn't, their religion is very strongly against my life, but I think, I've very rarely come across any family who don't appreciate me as a professional. And I think that's the space we're operating in, isn't it? It's that society is a space where we're all respected, we have our own identities, but we're allowed to disagree and still help each other. And I think that's such an important message, particularly in this day of social media when people are very happy to kind of criticize each other across the keyboard. Would you say this to a person's face? Would this get in the way of your professional activity? I think you've really got to think that and make sure that people feel recognized and valued for who they are.
Definitely. And what do you think would fuel the profession of speech and language therapy to kind of be more inclusive towards like minority groups, whether that be trying to encourage, people of different genders to be part of speech and language therapy, or kind of to encourage people who, might be from immigrant backgrounds or who might be people of color, whatever it is.
I think it's about really, it's kind of building, it's building work, and we're slowly getting there. I think it's about making sure that people see people who are successful. We've got lots of therapists who are people of color who I know who are bilingual, who are leading amazing services, doing wonderful things, and it's really promoting them. So a lot of the social media then can be really positive. So we've got Faces of SLT, we've got Bulletin magazine showing best practice. I think what we need to do is close the loop though and get young kids wanting to be speech therapists. People don't
Yes.
know what speech therapists do.
Yeah.
They think it's elocution, as you said before. I've had a
Like
panic
the
over
way it's
time. I said
portrayed.
that.
Yeah, it sounds like I know it sounds awful. The way that you kind of the way that it's portrayed, I think when you're younger is definitely like it's going to be both tedious and also going to be something that requires you to be like Basically, Rex Harrison, you know what I
Yes,
mean?
exactly. Yes, that's a good choice. Yes, Rex had the rain in Spain falls mainly on the plane. Yes,
Exactly.
absolutely. And I think that is really off-putting and really as far from the profession as you could probably get. So I think it's about we're a tiny profession. There's only about 22,000 members in the UK. You compare that with nursing, we're really tiny as a
Yeah.
profession. We're a very young profession. We're only 8 years old next year, and I think that's something to celebrate. But we're, it's a big thing to turn around. So I think really promoting people for the work they do and showing that people of color are an integral part of that. So I mean, I think we've really worked hard to get the Royal College board more diverse, to get our governance committees more diverse, to hear more voices. And I think if you then reach the younger kids, so when they're thinking of choosing the GCSEs, when they're thinking about their A levels, people who have done other degrees that are related, if you've done a psychology degree, what are you going to do with that? What about speech therapy? So I think we really need to reach out to people. And we've been, quite rightly, people have criticized materials and said, well, this isn't showing a person of color as an SLT, and that's changed. So I think it's making sure that representation is there, that role models are there, that we shout about the value of people of color, of all sorts of protective criteria. I think it's really saying, recognizing that we don't represent the community we serve, and that doesn't make us bad people. Most
No.
people come to speech therapy with very, very good aims to help people. But I think it's about centering. There's lots of talk about co-production, but do people really do it? Do you really listen? So in my trans service, we have evenings I spend, I stay in Manchester, we order pizza and we listen to our service users, and they
Yeah.
said, you use big words, we don't understand your terminology. It might be great that it's gender affirming, but we don't understand what it is. How do you translate this stuff? Because we've got
Yeah.
people of color and bilingual people in those environments. How do you translate developmental language disorder into MIRPRI or into Tamil? It's really challenging,
Yeah,
but I
it
think
is.
we have to get people from those communities and really center their experience so that they can tell us how we can do it, and we can bring what we've got to offer the party, which is our clinical skills, our linguistic abilities, our insight into those things, and really partner in getting that. And I think then when therapy seems like the profession feels like it is genuinely enhanced and kind of cooperative with those communities, I think only then will people feel comfortable to step into those professional roles.
Definitely, definitely. And do you have any advice for people who are in minority groups, either those who are considering the profession or maybe those who are kind of approaching somebody in the profession?
Yeah, I think if you're interested in speech therapy, go on LinkedIn, contact Royal College or your professional organisation, and they'll put you in touch with networks where there are people who will understand your perspective. I mean, we've talked about a lot of those today,
Yeah.
and you'll get people who can mentor you and can encourage you, and point you in the right direction, and will understand the kind of reticence and fears that you have around joining the profession. I think around if you're a service user or you're a parent or carer or a partner of a service user, we've got much better at being more inclusive. I think there's a long way to go, but I think services should be, our professional guidelines say we should be, HCPC says we have to provide assessment and therapy in a home language. We have to work with professional interpreters if they're re required. These are absolute rights. They're not
Yes.
reduced by we haven't got any money in the budget. That's nonsense. It's really about moving from having to demand your rights to that being more automatic. And I think services are moving towards that. But if it's not right, I think people need to let the services know that they're not meeting the needs of the communities, and then only by, giving that feedback can services really move on. Because you should get the same service whether you're speaking at home language, whether you're a person of color, or if you're an English monolingual child. And at the moment, I think, as you know, if you're somebody who is educated and middle class, it's much easier to understand the system, and we need to, we need a lot more help with that. I think government support in terms of access to services. So I remember Sure Start, that was fantastic for access because we went to places where hard to, I mean, there's no thing as hard to reach families. There are families who don't know about us and
Yes.
have and are overloaded with childcare, dealing with often very difficult life circumstances. And it really makes me mad when people say poverty causes speech language problems. I'm like, no, it doesn't. Poverty is
No.
self-replicating. I'm
Yeah.
old enough to know that these parents, when they were kids, had really poor parenting, really poor opportunities, and it's really hard to be, a very effective parent if you've never experienced those things yourself. So Sure Start was great for trying to break that cycle, but it needed to continue for many generations, really. And I think I would like to see more universal childcare. I would like to see the NHS up off its knees, really. And this is where, speech therapists don't like to kind of get involved in politics, but things like talking to your MP, if your service is being cut, things like that,
Yeah.
we have to advocate on the behalf of our service users. But do check with your manager because it's important we do things the right way as well.
Definitely. Definitely. And thank you so much. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
And just to say, it's been a real pleasure. I think it's unusual for me to talk about my career and diversity, and it's surprisingly kind of emotional, I suppose.
I
I'm not
agree. I find
like
that after these conversations too, I always realize, I just feel like every time I have a chat like this, I share a part of myself too.
absolutely. But I think it's worth it if we empower people to feel more confident about joining the profession, being part of the profession, and just know if you are an LGBT person, if you're a person of color, if you're bilingual, if you have a different religion, you are absolutely treasured in our profession. I really love diversity, and I just get such a kick about finding out about people. It's that professional nosiness again. I just
Yeah.
think it's so fascinating to find out about people. And I think you're the same from the questions you've asked me today.
Definitely, definitely. And I do completely agree with you. I think bringing more people from minority groups into professional settings like this can only be a plus because it's like having a secret weapon.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. So, yes, thank you so much.
Thank
It's
you
been a
so
real pleasure.
much.